My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
Do you know anything about that? What can you report at this stage? All right. Yumna, please take cover. If you are in a position to do so safely, you can explain to us what we're happening. If you are not in a position to do so safely, yes, then please get to safety.
No, it's okay. This is a missile attack on Palestine Tower, right in the middle of Gaza City.
Yumna, take a moment to breathe.
This is the moment on the 9th of October, 2023, when the Palestinian journalist Yumna Essayed is forced to take cover when an Israeli airstrike hits a building right behind her. She's visibly terrified, but manages to go on reporting. Yumna Essayed is today's guest on Kalam, and we'll be getting back to her in just a second. But first, we'd like to recommend listening to the beginning of this series on Palestine, since we start out by telling the story of modern Palestinian history, and it's helpful to keep the history in mind when thinking about what's happening in Gaza right now. I'd also like to remind you to subscribe to Kalam in whatever podcast application you're using right now, and to please give us a rating. It helps other people find out about us. And if you'd like to support independent journalism about the Middle East and Palestine, you can do so by signing up to our Patreon community for just $3 a month. This membership comes with bonus material and full-length interviews. Now, on to the show. Yumna Essayed was for many people, including myself, the media face of the war on Gaza. She's Palestinian-Egyptian and was living in Gaza on October 7. Soon, she found herself in the surreal position of reporting on the same calamities she herself was facing. Yumna and her husband and her children were displaced several times during this war on Gaza, and at times, they did not have enough food or water. Yumna has since chosen to evacuate Gaza for the sake of her kids. At the moment, she's traveling around the Western world, advocating for the Palestinian cause. Yumna Essayed needs no further introduction. Suffice it to say, I was struck by her bravery and humanity when she graciously consented to give me an interview during her recent trip to Stockholm, Sweden. So, without further ado, here's Yumna Essayed. Yumna Essayed, thank you so much for your important work and taking time to speak with us today, and welcome to the Kalam podcast.
Thank you, Edgar, for having me as part of your podcast. Thank you for being interested and for caring about speaking about Gaza in such a crucial time where this entire world needs to open their eyes towards what's happening, the atrocities that are happening towards the civilians in the Gaza Strip.
So we're in Stockholm right now, and you've just been in Copenhagen. Where are you living right now, and how are you doing since you evacuated Gaza?
So I evacuated Gaza after nearly 3 months of covering the war with my husband and my children. We were of the few lucky people who survived this genocide and were able to evacuate to Cairo, Egypt. This is where we're taking shelter now. Of course, I do have an Egyptian passport, and so do my children. But my husband doesn't. So my husband's condition is like all other Palestinians who are taking refuge in Egypt now. They have no residency. They have no official papers, except that they are granted permission to stay in Egypt. But they basically can't travel. They can't work. And many Palestinian children from Gaza now who are in Egypt can't go to school. So that's basically another tragedy to add to all the tragedies of the Palestinian population with only a Palestinian nationality.
And right now you're on kind of a advocacy tour. You were just in Copenhagen, like I said, and now you're in Stockholm. What is it that you hope to achieve?
Well, since I left Gaza, Edgar, I have been trying to survive this survival guilt that has been eating me inside. I made the choice or the decision of leaving Gaza that was actually taken by my dad to bring us out of Gaza, to save our lives, to save the lives of my children after being displaced for 5 times, being threatened by the Israeli army, being targeted more than once when I was in the field, and felt that it was my responsibility as a mother to care for the lives of my children, to save their lives. So I made that decision and I abided to my dad's decision and we evacuated to Egypt. But since then, I have been living with that survival guilt. And honestly, this advocacy that I'm doing to speak about Gaza, to speak about the genocide in Gaza, the details that you don't see on television and you don't hear about, this is what's helping me to survive from that guilt. And this is what's helping me to still go on. And I think that there is a lot that people really need to know about, because what you see on TV is really a very, very, very small fraction of what is actually happening, the reality of the bitter and tragic situation that the people are living in.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to get into all of that, everything that you experienced in Gaza. But first, I'd like to ask you about your personal background and what you were doing before October 7, how you kind of got into journalism and, sort of your life before October 7.
So I'm married to a Palestinian from Gaza. We met in Egypt when I first went to Egypt in 2016. And it's very strange because being born as a Palestinian means that you are born in this sea of troubles and challenges. I was just speaking yesterday and saying that it is literally, when you're a Palestinian, you're born with a spoon of suffering in your mouth. And everything is just imposed on you. You're just, that is your reality just for being a Palestinian. After the 2014 war, my husband went back to Gaza to check on his family. And he was stuck there, as simple as that. The restrictions of movement on Palestinians has been ongoing forever, since since the early times. You don't even know since when, since they were ever created, right? So the Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli siege since 2007, and part of these measures, or the siege measures, is the restrictions on the movement of people freely from Gaza. So we were in Egypt where he had his master's degree, my husband had his master's degree, and then PhD degree, and that's why he was allowed to stay and to live in Egypt.
And were you born in Gaza? Are you from Gaza?
No, I was not born in Gaza. I'm not from Gaza. So after that, when he went there, he was in Gaza for 6 months, and he was not allowed to leave Gaza. And in best case scenario, when you're allowed to leave Gaza, you have to register your name on a list on the Rafah border, and your turn basically comes a year later. So that has been the reality. In 2014, 1st December 2014, I took my 2-year-old, my 3-year-old, and I was pregnant with our third child, and I went into Gaza because we had been already 6 months apart, me and my husband. My children, they really needed their father, and it was negatively impacting them, and I could see it very clearly. And I decided to go into Gaza. I did not realize the reality that it was going to be very difficult to come out of Gaza, even if you do have another passport, through the Rafah border. So I went into Gaza. I tried to come out to give birth to my third child among my family in Egypt, but that didn't work out. I was able to travel from Gaza in 2016 for the first time, so 2 years later. I've been in Gaza since 2014, for the past 10 years. 2 years later, after being in Gaza, journalism for me was honestly a dream. It was a passion. But the life, the people, the culture that I saw in Gaza motivated me so much to chase that dream. And for Gaza to be the starting point where I would actually start the journey of being a journalist. So I started educating myself on how to be a journalist. And what I've realized after that is that what you learn about journalism, the integrity of journalism, the code of ethics of journalism, and that journalism is all about curiosity, about evidence, about fact-checking, and reporting it honestly to your audience, to the public. You're a truth-teller. All these facts about journalism that I educated myself about and I learned about, in the true world, they are hardly practiced.
Yeah.
And that was actually very, very obvious, especially when covering this genocide. It has become very obvious that many journalists do not follow the real journalism ethics and regulations and laws. Rather, they do follow their, let's say, political agendas or private agendas, which is completely indifferent to real journalism.
Yeah. What was it about the people of Gaza that inspired you? Because you were smiling when you were thinking about that. Because I think in the West, we either have an image of Gaza as, Hamas and radical Islamists, or victims and people that are being bombed. So tell us a bit about the spirit of the people of Gaza and the beauty that you were talking about.
So as you mentioned, this was also the idea that I had about Gaza, because this is all you could hear about Gaza outside, in the outside world, in anywhere, whether in the Middle East or in the West. Gaza was an unknown territory, basically an impoverished territory by the Israeli occupation, long-lasting occupation. All that people knew about Gaza was that it's a territory under siege that has ongoing conflicts and wars, and people did not really care what the story, what the history of Gaza was. They did not even care about the beauty of Gaza. And I saw that when I went there. I saw how much ambitious the people were there, how much they love life. And despite all the restrictions that they live within, they make the best out of their life. And they want to live and they want to prosper and they cherish life very much. And they are educated. The young generations in Gaza are very educated. They know the history better than anyone else, better than adults I've seen in different areas of this world. They can speak to you and they can analyze situations, and they know the history very well. So I was very taken by that, the idea of how educated their young generations wear. That was something that really excited me at the beginning. And their love to learn languages, to learn about life. It's a sad reality that so many Gazans have never left the Gaza Strip. They were never able to travel from the Gaza Strip. Adults over 30 and 40 and 50 years, they've never left Gaza once in their life. Yet, they can speak to you about different subjects in this world like they've been to these areas and to these locations and to these places. They can speak to you about your own country very well. So they educate themselves from inside Gaza because they know that they're not able to leave Gaza. And like, for example, let's say the medical system in Gaza. You find very, very talented doctors in Gaza, very talented dentists in Gaza. They have never left Gaza, they have never studied abroad, but yet they are amazing in their medical work. And this was actually pointed out by many international doctors that were able to come in for a short while in this genocide. And they've spoken of how brilliant and how talented the medical staff in Gaza is. So, and the inventions, you would find, we had this small boy who actually, who invented through a battery a system to actually generate some electricity. Wow. to light some bulbs in the tents. They have these amazing opportunities that they actually think, and they're very talented in creation, you know, because they're deprived of everything from the outside world. They invent their own from inside their Gaza.
Wow. Yumna, you were really the face of much of the early reporting on the war in Gaza in 2023. And I was in Cairo for a lot of that period in October and November doing reporting from there about the war and about, you know, how Egyptians were viewing the war in Gaza and the Palestinian issue. And I remember clearly when I was sitting in my room typing away my own reports, I just had Al Jazeera on all the time, and I just constantly saw your face, and I was struck by your professionalism and your courage. And I in fact saw this infamous, really scary scene where a building was hit right next to you. What was that like for you, reporting on something that you yourself were experiencing, insofar as you had to escape bombs and at the same time report on people escaping bombs? How was that?
It was actually a lot of mixed feelings in these situations, because at the end we're human beings. Like, I was terrified most of the times. I was afraid. I tried to keep myself safe as much as I could. But safety was really not a choice that was easy for us to make, because basically everywhere was targeted in Gaza. And but the good thing is that when you're in Gaza, when you're a resident of Gaza and you're a journalist at the same time, you don't need anyone to tell you the information. So when that building was struck behind me, it was a residential tower. It was one of the largest towers in the middle of Gaza City. And it terrified me because it came by surprise and it was very loud. Of course, in reality, it is so much more terrifying than what you see on your screen. But as soon as I I tried to restrain myself, and I looked there. I could identify the name of the building. I could identify which building it is. I know what this building is, and I know that it's a residential building. I know how many offices it has, what the offices are. I know exactly the location. So that's a privilege for a Palestinian journalist in Gaza. Gaza is a small place where we actually know everything in it. So you, maybe if it was another journalist from outside Gaza, he would be like, I don't even know where this place is, but it seems like a tower was hit. So that's, but you can't deny the pain. You can't deny the terror that you feel in these situations. At the end, we're human beings. We have feelings. We feel. And it has been so many other situations, like reporting. I at the beginning of the war also, that was on the second day, just like a couple of days later, I was reporting about a massacre that happened in Jabalia refugee camp in El Trans area. And that, like, we went there. It's the natural thing a journalist does, to go and cover the area that was directly hit, especially that a massacre where over 20 people were killed in those homes that were targeted. And that day, another targeting happened. And I just found myself in a situation where I need to run for my life, literally run for my life. And I might be lucky and survive, or I might not survive. So these situations, they really, they break you inside. You know, they really break you inside. They really affect you inside. And it's you think a lot about a lot of things in these situations. You just see, like, the entire tape of your life going by. I always saw my children. That was my greatest fear, to lose them or they lose me. It was even, I was afraid for myself, because I knew that if they lost me, how much it would hurt them, how much it would affect them. So that was like a constant fear that I carried along every moment of every day. And it did not get easier. It just got worse and worse every day. In any other place, as a journalist, you are granted that right to go and report, because it's your legitimate profession, right, labeled as a journalist, to be covering such attacks. But in Gaza, a journalist is a legitimate target for the Israeli occupation, for the Israeli army, at all times, in all areas. And that was a huge, it was an immense struggle for us. We're trying to do our job, but at the same time, we're trying to save our own lives. We're trying to keep ourselves alive. You imagine, like, how difficult it is? It was always like that. It was anywhere like that. Even when we were reporting from hospitals, which are supposed to be the relatively safe places, the hospitals were targeted. The yards of the hospitals were targeted. The vicinity of hospitals were targeted. And that also inflicted on us. The fact that from day one, our offices were targeted one after the other, it left us with very little equipment to work with. But yet, our motivation to cover this genocide was greater than all these challenges. Because it was basically where, you know, you're telling the story of your people and your land, and you are part of these people that are getting bombed. So when you speak about homes or areas or neighborhoods being bombed, you're actually talking about your own home and your own people and your own neighborhood being bombed as well. So you're just basically telling people your own story, just in a larger picture.
Yeah. I mean, I've personally been shocked at journalists around the world. I mean, many have acknowledged, but many have not, the fact that this has been the deadliest period for journalists in the entire world in recent memory. Over 100 journalists have been murdered in Gaza. But I wanted to ask you about, I've heard you speak in other interviews that very early on you realize that this is not like other wars. Gaza has been bombed many times and Hamas has fired rockets many times, but this, you immediately sort of knew that this was different. When did you realize this?
Well, since Israel started its attack on Gaza, it made it very clear that it was actually targeting civilian infrastructure, civilian homes. The statements of the Israeli ministers on the very first beginning, on the first days, saying that they will cut all water supply and all energy supply and impose a full blockade on Gaza, which has already been under Israeli siege for the past 17 years, was a clear evidence that this is a genocide on civilians and not a war against Hamas fighters. Because when you deprive civilians, living civilians, of the very basic necessities of life, which is water and electricity, you're actually taking their life away. And then the indiscriminate bombardment, and I call it indiscriminate because that is the correct term to define it, of bombarding civilian homes, entire neighborhoods. It's terrifying. Entire neighborhoods were bombarded. I mean, Jabalia, Beit Hanun, Al-Brej, Gaza City, entire neighborhoods completely wiped out. Nothing was spared. No one was spared. The numbers of civilians that were killed every hour, not every day, every hour, was scary. It was terrifying. From day one, this was a clear genocide. It did not. We did not have to wait for the first week, because clearly, by the first week, there was not just the imposing of the full blockade, the cutting of the water, the energy, the indiscriminate bombardment, but also the ethnic cleansing, the beginning of the displacement of over half of the population of the north and Gaza City, evacuating them to the south, or asking them to evacuate to the south, which is also not spared of the indiscriminate bombardment, and which is also living under the same inhumane conditions, without water, without electricity, without drinking water, without fuel. And the bombardments that targeted each and every area in Gaza, whether it's a shelter, UNRWA schools that were shelters for many Palestinians, thousands of Palestinians were killed without this world even saying anything about it or even condemning it. Like, I can't really comprehend when I think about all these atrocities that have been committed. How can you not call them atrocities? That is the right definition of an atrocity and a crime, to bomb unarmed civilians that are sheltering in a recognized shelter, a UN shelter, a UN school, to bomb a hospital, to continue bombing all the civil institutions and infrastructure for the people, and to deprive them of all their living, basic living necessities, and then you're still not willing to call this a genocide. It's just completely ignorant.
I think many people have seen the absolutely terrifying images of bombardment and of children and women dying and being, you know, buried under rubble. But the day-to-day experience of not having drinking water, can you tell us a little bit about what that's like?
So, I mean, water. Like, can you imagine not having water? Can you imagine how painful it is that your children are thirsty and you ask them to take just a sip of water because you can't find drinking water for them? We left to the south, we evacuated south the first time when the first call was made by the Israeli army. And in the south, very quickly, of course, we're talking about 2.3 million people living in the Gaza Strip. Once the water supply was cut from Gaza from the first day, the water quickly started running out, the supplies. Very few places in Gaza had water wells where there was still water being generated, but it was also very difficult to generate the water because there was no electricity to generate the water from underground,
This water is contaminated anyway, right? The water in the wells from before?
Most wells are not under, like, UN organizations have declared that most water in the Gaza Strip coming from these wells are not suitable for drinking. But yet, at least, it's not salty water,
yeah.
Right? So even that contaminated water was not available. We went south, and Edgar, we struggled to find drinking water. And that feeling that my children are thirsty and I can't provide them with water, it was just too painful to endure. I felt like the bombardments are ongoing anyway, whether in the north or in the south, but to die from thirst, it was just indescribable. It was something too difficult for me to understand, right? So we decided to return back to Gaza City, to our home in Gaza, where we had a water well in our building, because we wanted to die with dignity, not being deprived of drinking water. So we made that call and we took that journey back under the bombardments. And we stayed in Gaza City. We were able to drink water because we had water. And I am lucky because I'm one of the people who had a filter in my home. And other families who also returned with us to our building, they didn't have any water in their homes. So we basically filled up bottles for everyone in the building, which was a good thing. But then the bombardments, of course, got worse and worse, and we were trapped in our apartment, in our building, and we were not able to leave under the heavy bombardments that were non-stop, they were relentless. And that's when I got the warning call saying that the warning call or the threat came to my husband on his phone by a private number, someone who identified himself as an IDF officer, telling my husband clearly, we know who you are. He identified him with his full name. And he told him, we know who you are. Take your family and leave your home. Otherwise, your lives are in danger. And my husband's response was, you know that our area is under heavy bombardment. How can I take my children to the street under this heavy bombardment and risk them getting killed? And he just replied, this is your problem, not ours. So we weren't able to leave. And it was very obvious that if we left, we could have been bombed very easily. And so many times I did my lives on the phone with Al Jazeera at that time. And every single time it was a life, whether it was in the morning, in the afternoon, or in the evening, the bombardments, the airstrikes were clearly heard. Like they were nonstop, like it was ongoing and ongoing and ongoing. Of course, days later, we were forced to leave the building and our apartment when the Israeli soldiers were just 20 meters away from our building on another tower, just opposite to ours, called Mushtaha Tower, and they started shooting. They started shooting at our windows, just like that, not caring if they're going to actually kill us that way or not. Very terrifying moments, extremely terrifying moments. You can't imagine just being shot at from the window by sniper fire and trying to keep your children safe. And then they called out in their microphones to tell us to leave the building in 5 minutes. So we quickly got into our cars and we drove away. And even while we were in the car, before we drove away, we were shot at. I had to let my children all duck down to the ground of the car because I was afraid that they would get shot. And they didn't care if they would kill us right there while we're trying to flee for our lives. So when I say that it was running for your life every single time, it's literally running for your life. You know, these meanings, these terms, they have their literal meaning when it comes to Gaza.
All of this sounds like a horror film. It sounds completely terrifying, and it must have been completely terrifying. And yet, throughout all of this, you keep doing lives for Al Jazeera. You keep putting together reports. You keep working, you know, as a journalist myself on the field, I know the intense tempo of news production. Where did you get this energy from to keep working while literally escaping for your life, running away from sniper fire?
Well, I'm not going to lie. So many times I felt like I lost all my energy. I had no energy, not physical, neither emotional energy to continue going on. But Edgar, the suffering you see around you, that is like the biggest motivation to keep you going. The knowledge that you are the voice of these people that have no voice gives you that energy to keep going. So every single time I felt that I can't go on anymore, I told myself that I can't act selfish now. I can't give up now. If I give up now, I won't be able to go on. I had to be strong for my children first. Because when they see me strong, they're strong. They can survive. This was something my 8-year-old told me. She told me, when we see you crying and when we see you weak, we see everything black, you know? And she said, you have to be strong so that we survive. And she's my 8-year-old. And that day I made the promise to myself that I won't give up. I won't give up. Many times I was devastated, I was broken, I was desperate. I wanted this to end. Many times I just wanted to die because I was tired of fighting for survival, trying to survive. But I always wondered, what happens if I give up and die? There's a lot to be done. There is a lot to be said. There is a lot to be reported. And that's why at the last month of my, or month and a half from being in Gaza, I stepped away from the camera, from giving up the latest developments on camera. And I did reports, stories, because the challenges and those very small details that people lived and were not reported on camera enough. They were not reported in the daily and latest updates. Okay, they were very important. They mattered very much. They mattered that people would see inside the hospitals how it looked like, other than just reporting that 100 have been killed or 100 have been injured. I wanted people to see the kinds of injuries that children are injured, and how are the kind of weapons that are being used on the civilians to kill them. These details mattered a lot to me, and that's why I was concerned and I was busy just reporting on and doing these stories, because these stories are the stories that have the evidence for saying that Israel is using unlawful weapons against the civilians in Gaza, the kinds of bullets that Israel uses to kill people that can either completely damage their organs from inside so they don't survive, or if they're shot in their arms or legs, that part is amputated. The burns in the children from the rockets that they use. It was very important to report about all these details. It was very important to report about the kinds of tents, because people saw a lot of tents and they think that, oh, they're safe in tents. No, they're not safe in tents. Look at the tents. These tents, they sink in the rain and they don't protect them from the cold and they don't keep them safe from the bombs. And they don't have water or toilets in these areas. People needed to know about the contagious diseases that have been spreading widely among children especially. They needed to see the pictures of the rows of the hospitals, the corridors that had mothers carrying their babies and children from inside the hospitals. They needed to see all these details. And this was just a little of what I could do, a little of what I could help voice the voiceless about in Gaza.
Yeah. We're very grateful for that, that you were able to pull through and have the strength to do that. It really gave the rest of the world an idea of what was happening in Gaza and what's still happening. So how did you, in the end, reach the decision to evacuate with your children?
Well, actually, the decision was made by my dad, who is in Egypt, and he had been making efforts for a very long time to try to bring me, my children, and my husband out of Gaza to Egypt, and it finally worked out. So he basically made the decision for us. I know that I had reached to a point where I had lost all energy. I felt that I wasn't even able to carry on in continuing to protect my children. I had already evacuated 5 times from place to another. Same struggles, just worse day after day. It was not just water now, it was even food, where some days I just had 1 pack of biscuit to distribute on my 4 children, 2 biscuits each, until I was able to get them a loaf of bread to be divided on them. It was this bad. It was this difficult. I evacuated to the south on foot with my children and my husband, and I wasn't able to take any clothes with us. So I didn't find any clothes for my children, Edgar, my 5-year-old. I didn't find her anything to keep her warm. Can you like imagine how painful that is for a parent, that you know that you can't keep your own child warm? Because basically there was nothing left. Nothing is entering Gaza. And what we were in summer and we approached, winter approached, we entered winter and there was nothing in the markets, no winter clothes left. And it was just getting worse and worse. The challenges were getting more and more complicated every day. And I felt that I didn't have the ability to protect them anymore. So I heeded and I evacuated the Gaza Strip, that's my family, safely to Egypt. But speaking about Gaza now, around the world, is what I can continue to be doing for Gaza.
Yeah, Yumna Sayed, thank you so much for your time, and I know that you have a busy schedule. There is a huge amount of support for Palestine, especially right now going on in many university campuses in the US, and it's starting in Europe as well. How do you feel when you see things like that?
I feel that they're very very essential and very necessary, and I believe in the power of people, and this is what I have been saying over and over. We need the people to continue shouting out for this genocide to end, but it's not just the ending of the genocide, it's the ending of the genocide, it's the flowing of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, it's basically the allowing of international organizations to enter the Gaza Strip, the crucial need for support and solidarity around the world for the people of Gaza. The power of the people is very important and it matters a lot. And one voice can't do a lot, but the more it spreads, the more powerful it is, and then a change can be really done.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, Yumna Sayed, for speaking with us today in the Kalam podcast.
Thank you, Edgar. Very delighted to be here and for being heard out in your podcast. Thank you.
That was the Palestinian-Egyptian journalist Yumna Sayed in the 8th episode of Kalam. I hope you enjoyed it. Last week, I said I would be interviewing the Palestinian-American filmmaker Munir Atallah this week. Rest assured, I will be publishing that interview. But things are happening so fast on the ground right now, everywhere from Gaza to the US, that on this episode, I'm going to refrain from predicting who I'll be speaking to next week. But to find out more, follow us on social media at Kalam Podcast. Until then, that's all from us. Kalam was written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production by Sam Karl Samra. Poetry reading in Arabic by Khulud Saghir. And sound design by Arthur Mannheimer.